We have seen Paul begin his journey by ship to Rome, along with other prisoners who were sent by the governor Festus. Luke is among those accompanying him, and he's providing us with an eyewitness account of the voyage. Initially, they're aboard a small ship that passes the island of Cyprus and then hugs the coast of Asia Minor until it reaches the port city of Myra in the region of Lycia. At that point, the centurion who's in charge transfers the prisoner to a larger ship that's fit for sailing through the Mediterranean and is heading to Italy. But immediately they had a tough time of it, eventually reaching the island of Crete. But winter was approaching, the time when the Romans referred to the Mediterranean as the closed sea because it was too dangerous to navigate. The ship finds shelter from the strong winds by staying close to the shore of Crete until they make it to a place called Fair Havens near the city of Lycia. Now, despite its name, the harbor of Fair Havens was not the fairest place for a ship to winter, and it was very exposed to sea and storms. It did not provide the kind of protection they would desire, given the season that was approaching. Now, drawing on his experience at sea, Paul warned against moving on from Fair Havens. He said, "Men, I perceive that this voyage will end with disaster and much loss, not only of the cargo and ship, but also of our lives." And so a decision had to be made. Would they stay there? Would they move forward? Paul advised against it, but the centurion chose to follow the advice of the helmsman and the ship owner to try to reach the better harbor of Phoenix, which under good conditions was just about a day's sail away. And that's where we pick up the action tonight as a ship is leaving Fair Havens in an attempt to reach that harbor for the winter. We'll track the voyage sort of verse by verse, working our way through the passage. So verse 13, "When the south wind blew softly, supposing that they had obtained their desire, putting out to sea, they sailed close by Crete." So the sailors were there in that harbor of Fair Havens, biding their time, waiting for conditions to be right so that they could sail to Phoenix. And they felt that that time had come when the south wind blew softly. A soft wind from the south was perfect for their short voyage, which was to the northwest. And they set sail, hugging the coastline of Crete as they went. Verses 14 through 15, "But not long after, a tempestuous wind arose called Euroclydon. So when the ship was caught and could not head into the wind, we let her drive." It didn't take long for the weather conditions to change. We're told that a tempestuous wind rose called Euroclydon. Now, that word in the New King James, it's just a transliteration of the Greek. But it refers to what mariners call a northeaster. And some of the other English translations actually put that there. It was called the northeaster. And what that tells us is that the wind changed both in direction and ferocity. No longer was it coming from the south and gently moving in the direction that they wanted to sail. Rather, it was coming from the northeast. It was now a hurricane-force wind driving over the mountains of Crete directly against their intended direction. Ships at that time were not designed to tack, and they could not sail directly into the wind, so they turned the ship around and let the wind take it where it would. That's what it means by the sense that we let her drive. They're not really in control of the ship now. They're at the mercy of the storm. Verse 16, "And running under the shelter of an island called Clauda, we secured the skiff with difficulty." Well, we know now that the wind drove them over 20 miles until they were able to find some shelter in the lee of the island of Clauda. And they took that opportunity to haul the skiff, that was the dinghy or the lifeboat that had been tethered to the ship. They brought that aboard with some difficulty, no doubt. It was filling with water, not an easy thing to get aboard. But having it on board meant that they would have a means to venture from the ship if it were ever necessary and if circumstances allowed. Verse 17, "When they had taken it on board, they used cables to undergird the ship. And fearing lest they should run aground on the Syrtis sands, they struck sail and so were driven." As another safety measure, they used cables or perhaps ropes to undergird the ship. Most likely, this meant that they were passing ropes actually under the hull and sort of tying the ship together at multiple places, providing a sort of girdle to hold it together. And this would hopefully keep the ship from breaking apart in the midst of the storm. Now, they knew the wind was blowing them in the direction of North Africa, which would mean heading toward the Syrtis, which was a broad gulf off the Libyan coastline that was notorious for its shallows and shifting sandbars. It was notorious as a place where ships were wrecked. And where the New King James here has "they struck sail," the Greek literally reads "they lowered their gear or their tackle." And while this word can refer to the mainsail, most translations reflect the understanding that what they lowered was a sea anchor. And they lowered that sea anchor that they would drag along with the hope that that would slow down the progress of the ship, make it less likely that they would just smash into something at high speed. Well, verse 18, "And because we were exceedingly tempest-tossed, the next day they lightened the ship." So tossed about in the storm the next day, they throw some of the cargo overboard to lighten the ship. Now, the financial loss this would entail shows the desperate nature of their situation. After all, they are being paid to transport both prisoners and cargo. And the ship owner is even there, but they realize that it was better to survive the storm at a loss of profit than to go down to a watery grave with heavy cargo, and perhaps due in part to that cargo. So they tossed out some of the cargo, but even that was not enough. Verse 19, "On the third day, we threw the ship's tackle overboard with our own hands." Now remember, Luke is the narrator here, and Luke writes, "We threw the ship's tackle board overboard with our own hands." Apparently, the crew is being joined by passengers in jettisoning the tackle. Now these would be the tools ordinarily used to control the ship, something you would never toss overboard if you had any hope of having the ship in control. But that which was usually a great tool for navigation was contributing to the weight of the ship. And they tossed it over again in hope of lightening the ship. And I think in doing so, they're acknowledging not only that they can't control the ship at the present, but they really don't expect to ever be able to do so again. It's really a desperate measure, continuing to try to lighten the ship in the water. Verse 20, "Now when neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and no small tempest beat on us, all hope that we would be saved was finally given up." Now because of the clouds and the rain of the storm, Luke writes that neither sun nor stars appeared for many days. Now that would be very significant to a mariner in the first century, because their only way of plotting their location and engaging in navigation was through the heavenly bodies. But they could not see them. And what that meant was they had no idea exactly where they were and no idea precisely where they were heading. They were in the open seas. They knew Syrtis Sands were somewhere ahead in the darkness. And because of that situation, we're told all hope that we would be saved was finally given up. So they've really reached the nadir of their situation. They've tossed things overboard. They can't see. They can't navigate. They don't even know where they are. And they've just given up hope. And Paul now speaks into their desperate situation. Verse 21. "But after long abstinence from food, then Paul stood in the midst of them and said, 'Men, you should have listened to me and not have sailed from Crete and incurred this disaster and loss.'" Now, it talks about abstinence from food, and this word translated abstinence does not refer to fasting. It refers to a lack of appetite. And this is probably due to a combination of anxiety and seasickness. I don't know about you. I am subject to seasickness. And if that comes upon me when I'm on some kind of a boat, the last thing that I want to do is eat. And that's likely the situation they were in. But Paul stands among these weary and sickened people on the ship, and he begins to address them. "Men, you should have listened to me and not have sailed from Crete and incurred this disaster and loss." Now, this sounds like Paul is saying, "See, I told you so." And to a certain extent, he is. but probably not in an entirely negative way, because what he wants to do is he wants to remind them of the truth that he had said before so that they will listen to what he has to say now. The idea is, if you agree now that you should have listened to me back then, now you should be ready to listen up. And so he continues speaking, verse 22, "And now I urge you to take heart, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship." Now this is different than what he had said before. Remember, back at Fair Havens, he had said, "Men, I perceive that this voyage will end with disaster and much loss, not only of the cargo and the ship, but also our lives." So he had anticipated three things being lost: the cargo, the ship, and their lives. Now he urges them to take heart, to be courageous, because though the ship and cargo would be lost, their lives would be spared. Well, why the different message now? Well, remember, before, there's every indication that he had merely spoken from human wisdom gleaned from his personal experience. He had been through a few shipwrecks. He knew something about what it was like to be on the Mediterranean in a tempestuous storm. And so he's really giving sort of advice from his own experience. But now, he has a more sure foundation for his words, as we see as we continue into the next two verses. Paul is speaking, "For there stood by me this night an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I serve, saying, 'Do not be afraid, Paul. You must be brought before Caesar. And indeed, God has granted you all those who sail with you.'" So Paul now speaks, not just from his own experience and wisdom, but as a result of divine revelation brought to him by an angel of God. Remember, he's here among pagans, and so he speaks of the God to whom I belong. "And the God to whom I belong has revealed three things to me," he says. The first message is, "Do not be afraid." And they're probably thinking, well, easier said than done, Paul. You know, I mean, look where we are. We've just given up hope. But Paul's saying, no, don't be afraid. And then the message personally for Paul: "You must be brought before Caesar." And then thirdly, "God has granted you all those who sail with you." Now this "must," in the phrase "you must be brought before Caesar," is what we could call very untechnically a divine must. It must happen because Jesus had previously told Paul that it would happen. He had told him that he would go to Rome. And whatever happens to the ship and to the others aboard, in some way, Paul must survive in order to reach his destination in Rome. But what we see here is that God's mercy extends beyond Paul, perhaps in answer to his prayers. Because along with him, and God seems to indicate because of him, God is going to spare the lives of all the people on the ship. Not a single life would be lost. And if we were to glance ahead at verse 27, we find that there were a total of 276 people aboard. So this is quite the crowded ship. There are an awful lot of people that are being tossed about in this storm. They've given up hope. They expect to be wrecked. But Paul tells them, "My God has assured me that none of you will die." So he continues verses 25 and 26. "Therefore take heart, men, for I believe God that it will be just as it was told me. However, we must run aground on a certain island." So it begins, therefore, on the basis of what I've just told you, I have told you what the angel of God told me, which includes the fact that none of our lives are going to be lost. Therefore, take heart. Therefore, take courage. You have reason to take courage. And the basis is that Paul testifies, "I believe God that it will be just as it was told me." And Paul wants them to share his faith in the word God has given them. The apostle is not exalting himself. He's not saying that he's some kind of wonder worker who foresaw the future in the past and now he's foreseeing it again. He's not drawing any attention to himself. He's exalting God. And he also adds another detail that was apparently part of the revelation he received. "However, we must run aground on a certain island." A little footnote there. This is what's going to happen. We're being tossed about in the sea, but in order to be saved, we're going to run aground on a certain island. Now, this is really more amazing than it may sound to us, because really, where they were in the midst of the Mediterranean, there was only one possible island that could be the place where they would run aground, and that's the island of Malta. And we'll see that is indeed where they go. Malta has an area of about 95 square miles. It's located in the Mediterranean, about 60 miles from Sicily. And commentator Daryl Bach remarks that finding Malta would be like finding a needle in a haystack. So to tell them they're going to run aground on a certain island is to tell them something that they believe is virtually impossible. Here they are in the middle of the sea. There's almost no islands at all. And yet he tells them they're going to run aground on an island. And it will be an act of God's providence for the ship to reach this island so all on board can be saved. And that is what Paul is directing their attention to, directing attention to his God, the God of Israel, whom he worshiped, who is in control of these things, who has spoken in advance about what will happen and has assured them that they will be spared. And therefore, in light of God's message, they should be courageous. Now, I think this passage exemplifies the first verse of what will be our closing hymn tonight. That verse begins, God moves in a mysterious way his wonders to perform. He plants his footsteps in the sea and rides upon the storm. When Jesus assured Paul that he would testify in Rome, the apostle surely could not have anticipated the way that he would get there. It is a mysterious way indeed, but it is a way that magnifies God's power and grace and leaves no doubt that Paul is in his hands and gives him even more opportunity to testify to God to those who are aboard the ship. Now, we have heard Paul speak of his God to those on the ship, and he soon would surely be able to tell them he plants his footsteps in the sea and rides upon the storm. And I suspect it will be hard for them to gainsay the accuracy of Paul's words of hope that came to them in the midst of the storm.